Kia ora and welcome to the C Word Radio, the podcast for cancery people who want real conversations about cancer. I'm your host, Helen King. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find good podcasts. Hello, my friend. Welcome to the very last episode for 2021 of the C Word Radio. I hope you had a lovely Christmas day and completely disgraced yourself with overeating delicious Christmas food on Christmas Day with your friends and family. I can't believe we're at the end of 2021. I keep mentioning this, but I feel like 2020 and 2021 are basically just like one big year that has merged into each other, and we've been in some sort of episode of the Twilight Zone. But within all of the chaos, I have to say I am so proud of what I have achieved with this podcast. Over 30 episodes featuring people from all over the world sharing their cancer stories. And I am also really proud of my campaign during Breast Cancer Awareness Month, This is Breast Cancer, where 30 people from different countries shared their stories with me over social media. It was such an amazing experience to, you know, really be able to give insight to what breast cancer really is like behind all the pink and fluff that we often get during that month. So thank you. Thank you to all my guests. It is such a privilege to share your stories. And thank you, my dear listener. You keep coming back. You keep listening, which means so much to me. I love it. And I love hearing from you. So please get in touch if there's anything that you want to share, if there's anything that you've loved with this year. You can find me on Instagram at the C Word underscore radio, on Facebook, the C Word Radio. Come say hi. I'm really excited for 2022. Not so much for whatever dumpster fire will continue to happen. I'm excited for my plans for the C Word Radio. In 2022, I really want to be focusing more on young survivorship. I feel like I have gravitated more towards that anyway in my guests, but it's something that I feel really strongly about in sharing what it is like to have had cancer as a younger person. If you've listened for a while, you will know that I don't love the word survivor or survivorship. They really don't sit comfortably with me. I was chatting recently with a woman and she made a really good point, and I think this kind of gets to the center of it for me. And she was talking about the fact that people often, when they come through treatment, or this is how she felt, she came through treatment and she doesn't feel like she's been able to talk really openly about the hard stuff because she doesn't want to seem ungrateful. And I believe that we can be grateful and really pissed off that we've had cancer. For me, that's been part of healing, is to give my experience a voice and to hold both of those things. Like, I am so grateful I'm alive and that I have had another trip around the sun, but I'm also really angry, and sometimes I feel a lot of grief because my life has changed so much, and that can be pretty hard that when life doesn't quite go as you expect. So I think we need to hold both intention, and that it is totally fine if you don't feel grateful some days. Before I introduce my guest, I have a very small request. If you are listening on Spotify, there's actually now a function to leave a rating and review. So if you enjoy the podcast, please give it a rating. It makes the podcast more discoverable on Spotify, and I would love more cancery people to find the podcast. The last two episodes of the year feature inspiring women who have written books about their cancer experiences. Last week, Hilda Manuel Dixon shared her story about her daughter going through aggressive cancer. If you haven't listened, please go back and listen to it. It was such a beautiful conversation with Hilda. And I will leave all of those links in the show notes, because her book as well, I think, will make great summer reading. My guest today has had an extraordinary journey over the past 12 years. In 2009, Barry Ross heard the words, "You have cancer." Days after, her husband Charles was also diagnosed with cancer. Barry has published a book about her experience, Stronger with Two, the inspiring true story of a husband and wife winning the battle against cancer together. Barry's experience has not been easy. She went through grueling treatment for late-stage metastatic head and neck cancer. She was told at the time she would have maybe 5 years to live, and it has now been 12. At the same time, Charles was being treated for leukemia. The couple had to learn to lean on the support of their friends and family to get them through, and it was not a walk in the park either once they had both finished their treatment. Barry is passionate about advocating for equality in healthcare for people of colour, and she now works as a peer support worker for cancer patients. This is Barry's story. I am very excited to be talking to you because your story is it's pretty spectacular. And I think I always struggle to find the right words when it comes to cancer because, you know, cancer, it can be such an awful experience for people. But I think within that, some days that pain and the struggles that we go through, we can come out the other end with a lot more strength than we ever thought that we may have had. So I would like to just start at the beginning because I think that's probably the best place to start, where both of you are diagnosed with cancer at the same time. So talk to me a little bit about how it all started.
It was the spring of 2009. We are both 12-year survivors as of right now. And the spring of 2009, we were living in Phoenix, Arizona, in the United States. And I guess the late spring, early spring, my husband started feeling awful. He just was weak and fatigued all the time. And he started going to the doctors, and they didn't know what was wrong with him. And they were treating him for infections, and nothing was getting better. Actually, he was getting sicker and weaker. So I go to the doctor with him. Maybe we're 8 weeks in with all of the confusion about him, and I go to a doctor's appointment with him. And so he had some swelling, and they said they thought he had a lymph node infection. So as he's talking to the doctor, he tells the doctor, he says, well, you know, maybe whatever I have is contagious because my wife has a swelling. And I was like, I do? And he said, and I said, honey, I hadn't noticed that. And he goes, yeah, right behind your right ear. And I put my finger there and I felt it. And I said, I do. And so my husband suggested that the doctor look at me. And the doctor looked at me and he says, I don't know what's wrong with your husband, but I have some suspicion about what's going on with you. Could you come back tomorrow? Came back the next day. He took a fine needle and stuck it in my swelling behind my ear. And 2 days later, he calls me up and he says, I don't know. I still don't know what's wrong with your husband, but you have cancer.
Wow.
And I was like, wow, I have cancer? And he's like, yeah. And he said, I want you to leave here and go get a CAT scan. And we're going to do some further tests. So I went home. I didn't even tell my husband. He was practically bedridden. And I said, okay, let me just wait and go back to the doctor. I had a test, went back to the doctor, and he walked in the room and he said, scheduled my husband for a biopsy 2 days later. But he walks in the room and he says, Mrs. Ross, you have cancer. It's called squamous cell cancer. And not only is it spread, and he said, yes, it's metastasized. It's in your lymph nodes, and it's coming out of your tonsil, out of your right tonsil. So my question was, so what are we going to do about it? Because I had no idea if it was stage one, whatever the stages were. And so what are we going to do about it? And he said, well, you know, the best hospital out here, and I don't know if this is an issue with insurance, because some countries just have, you know, just go to the hospital. But in the United States, it became an insurance conversation. And he says, you know, the hospital that could probably help you a whole lot, they don't take your insurance. And I said, okay, so what are we going to do about it? And he said, the next guy, the next doctor who is good at this kind of cancer and has success with patients. He doesn't take your insurance either. So now I'm getting frustrated because he was having an insurance conversation and I wanted to have a Save Barry's Life conversation. And they weren't coming together. So I suggested to him that he give me my test and my records and I would go somewhere else, but that he keep working on my husband. He gave me everything as it was. My daughter worked at the cancer center in Atlanta, Georgia. So as soon as I left the office, I called her and she said, send me whatever he told you. It sounds very serious. Faxed it to her. 20 minutes later, she calls me and she's, mother, this is very serious. And I showed it to the doctors here at the cancer center and they want you to get here tonight. I was like, I can't fly out tonight. I said, I still don't know what's wrong with Charles, my husband. And as it was, I then called a relative. She came and stayed with him. I ended up in Atlanta 2 days later. And at the hospital, while I was talking to the people at the hospital, my husband's sister calls and she says, okay, so they diagnosed your husband from the biopsy and he has leukemia. Oh my God. I said, he has leukemia. And she goes, and he is a wreck. He's emotionally a wreck. And I'm waiting for the doctor to come in and tell me what they're going to do for me. And my daughter, when she hears that he has leukemia, she arranged the call with his doctor and the doctor at Emory University Hospital. And they started talking and they're like, we have to get him here because both of you all are in pretty bad shape. Even though I was still up walking and talking, no pain or whatever, I was in bad shape. Mm. So we're both diagnosed within 72 hours. We were both diagnosed with very serious cancers. My cancer was stage 4. And late stage and was a very aggressive and moving quickly. And his cancer was, he was in bad shape, actually. He was in pretty bad shape because his immune system was shot. Mm. And his fatigue and just everything. He was sleeping 20 hours a day. So they flew him here. We were both at the hospital, couldn't see each other. Because of his immune system, had determined that my best chances at with that late stage was for them to be very aggressive with the treatment. Mm. So I immediately was given a protocol of 35 radiation treatments and chemo all at the same time. Yeah. Most people do one first and then the other. The way my cancer was spreading and the kind of cancer that I had and where it was located, it was base of tongue, but it was in all my lymph nodes. And my husband was in the hospital getting 23-hour-a-day. Yeah. I mean, it's unbelievable. 23-hour-a-day chemo, 1 hour off, and the rest of the time he's in bed getting chemo. In the middle of all of this, my daughter discovers she and her husband are pregnant. But now she's got two parents that are one in the hospital, one daily trips being treated as an outpatient for chemo with chemo and radiation. And that was my oldest daughter. We brought her sister in who lived in Washington, D.C. And it just became, it was incredible because my cancer, I couldn't eat, I couldn't swallow. I had a feeding tube. The pain was incredible. And so they had to put together a team of friends and family just to come help me because I needed a lot of hands-on. And my husband was in the hospital, but they were trying to go visit him. And it was just like the perfect storm. That's what I call it. Everything that could go wrong was going wrong. And just staying hopeful became a challenge.
It's my head still reels from the fact, so I guess in New Zealand, we do have a public health system. We also have private, but it's more, you can have insurance, but it's not necessary because theoretically, if you get ill, you should be able to go to the hospital here and be treated. It's your story for me is part of my head still gets stuck around what that is like of being told you have cancer, it's aggressive, but let's talk insurance. Because right. you've just been given this explosion of information mm-hmm. that you have cancer, and they're talking, but we can't treat you. Sorry, but we can't treat you. And it's just
right.
that in itself is huge. But then your story is, and then this happened, and then this happened, and I can't even imagine how do you keep hopeful in that? How do you, you're going through that treatment, I think about my experience, so much of your energy mm-hmm. goes into keeping yourself getting through it.
Yes.
But your husband's going through it too. And so I can imagine part of you just torn between wanting to be there for him, but needing that energy for yourself.
And that was, it was a big problem.
Yeah.
Because in most situations, one spouse helps take care of the yeah. other as a caregiver. And then when the doctor says to you, you can't worry about that. You have to just concentrate on yourself. Or when they were telling my husband, you can't worry about
yeah.
it. And then when I couldn't see him to know how he was doing, and he couldn't see me, I mean, weeks at the time, months, literally a couple of months went by before we could even be in the same room, because his immune system was, and with the leukemia. And as I started taking the radiation and the chemo, my immune system became totally compromised. My neutrophils yeah. were like zero.
Wow.
And then I was on all kind of pain medicine, because his cancer wasn't painful. Mine was very painful. And so there were days that I didn't even know I was here. I just didn't even know what was going on. And fortunately, my daughters were able to talk to the doctors and then talk to me when I was coherent to say, Mommy, this is what's going on and this is what's happening.
Mm.
And the other thing, and I want to stay with that a little bit, is that you're right. When you're sick, you should be constant. Your efforts should be on getting well and getting through, and not on insurance and not on paperwork and those kinds of things. And it's the doctors are telling you, okay, just concentrate on this. But you're in the hospital and the finance people are coming in and saying, what's your insurance going to do? They're going to cover this. They're not covering that. And you're torn, and you shouldn't be.
No. And I guess the thing that is relatable to that for possibly anyone who's here in New Zealand or possibly in Australia, which some of my listeners are, is we have, part of our system is great. The fact that you should be able to be treated, but we don't have the access to some of the newer drugs or all of the drugs that people may not, that people in the States or the UK or even Australia may have. And actually, at the time of recording, there has just been a huge inquiry into our funding body, and they have said, you're not doing good enough, because I don't think people realise how expensive cancer is, not just in terms of if you can't access the treatment that you need to, and you need to fundraise for that treatment, which a lot of people do here, or the fact that you're not working. And so there's this huge financial toll that really isn't spoken about.
One of the things that I know and have read about and studied is in the United States, as you said, versus New Zealand, how many people lose everything. They lose their houses, they lose their savings. I mean, cancer diseases are very expensive, but cancer it's out there by itself. Okay, because you're right. You cannot work and get 35 radiations and chemo and stuff. You just can't. And even if you're fortunate enough to be in remission, the healing from the treatment, that's at least another year or so.
Mm-hmm.
And then the long-term side effects from anything from neuropathy to lymphedema to depending on where your cancer is are something else to be considered. And you're right, nobody talks about that.
Oh, it's so true. I'm 2 years out of treatment because I did have a year of a drug called Herceptin, which is immunotherapy, and about three and a half years out from my of diagnosis. And I really am just starting to address a lot of that stuff that you just listed, right. Like my lymphedema, right. And my right arm, the scar tissue, mm-hmm. where my breast was removed, mm-hmm. just trying to, heal some of that stuff. And I think that's something that I've tried to talk about a lot, is that once treatment ends, I feel like often that's when the work starts. That can be even harder because you've just been through this enormous experience. And a lot of people feel, I felt just broken body, mentally, emotionally, spiritually.
And the fact of the matter is some of the things about it, you don't get over, you just go on. Okay, I still have swallowing, 10 years, 12 years later, 11 years later, I still have swallowing issues from the surgery.
Yeah.
I still have limited range of motion where in the surgery they went in to get, I think they removed some like 60 lymph nodes. Mm. But the surgery, also I don't have any feeling on this side of my face, the neck, because they had to take out nerves and stuff. So, I mean, some things are just going to be with me from that cancer experience physically, mm-hmm. okay, or as long as I live. And then I talk to people all the time who still have PTSD. And they still have PTSD from the experience. And then they also have, which I am just now coming to grips with that, about, oh, is it going to come back? The whole conversation. And the least little thing is the cancer back. The least little, you need to go get tested because we see something. And so that whole mental part, like you said, the mental, the emotional, the spiritual part is more than just physical. You're absolutely right.
And I feel like this is part of your experience and what I find quite beautiful in a way that, I mean, you were told you had metastatic cancer and stage 4 cancer, and those are words that a lot of people, it's devastating. How, talk to me around that and how that, I guess, impacted you at the time. But then I know that your faith and prayer and holding on to hope was a really big part of getting you through this experience. So I'd love to hear more about that part of your journey.
When I was first diagnosed, when I was first told that I had squamous cell cancer, and I was so hopeful. Again, I had no idea. And my daughters and I, we were talking when they said what it was, and then they had to do the staging, which came a little later. And so we were talking and, we did the Google thing, which I tell people, if you get a diagnosis, don't go to WebMD, don't Google, because don't do that. And we were so hopeful and we were like, oh, it's probably stage 2 and you'll do the chemo and it'll be okay. And it's stage 2. That's all we kept saying.
Yeah.
And when a week later, after they did the biopsy and did the a panoscope or something. And when we went back and we were walking in and we were like, okay, we're ready to hear stage 2. And the doctor said it's stage 4B. And I was just rocked.
Yeah.
And I was back on my heels and my daughter, her whole face, her head dropped.
Yeah.
And my youngest daughter was on the phone and she screamed out, no, not stage 4, not stage 4B. And, I was still hopeful, not even understanding what 4B meant. 4B meant that they were going to, and he told me, he says, it's very aggressive. We're going to throw everything we can at it.
Yeah.
If it was 4C, we'd probably tell you to start looking for hospice or palliative care or whatever, but it's B. And so there's a reason to hope that the protocol we put will at least buy you 5 more years. That's the normal survival rate for what I had. And I'm twice that now. My whole question again became, I'm a practical person. And okay, so what are we going to do about it? What are we going to do about it? That's all I kept asking. And this Emory Hospital is one of the top hospitals in the world. Winship Cancer Center is really one of the top cancer hospitals in the world. And some of the top doctors, people come from all over the world to be treated here. And then I started thinking, okay, this is what the doctor's going to do. What am I going to do? I'm going to stay hopeful. I'm going to stay prayerful. I'm going to be transparent with everybody. I talk about it because that's the other part of cancer. People don't want to talk about it. They want to hide it. They don't want to. I was campaigning. I was like, look, I tell people, I need prayer. I need your hope. I need your help. My husband and I, but the whole thing was, it wasn't just me, my husband and I, and then the impact it was having on our family. And I started calling friends and family all over the place. I was literally campaigning for prayers and for help, not even financial help, just come feed me, come pour the stuff, give my daughter a break and come over and fill my feeding tube, give my daughter a break, and instead of her trying to do everything, drive me to the hospital for a couple of days. Yes. So I really had to start taking a broader view and be humble and not be proud and be humble and say, we need help. And that's what happened. The more transparent I was, the more people, even people we didn't know, started showing up to help. And that became major.
I think that is such an excellent message because I feel very similar, where I'm very practical too. So I instantly went into, right, we've got to do this and this. And I think when you're in the thick of it, it's really not necessarily the emotional side of things that you need just yet. But I've often said to people since, because people will say, oh, my friend's been diagnosed or this has happened. And I say, do practical things. If they have kids, take the kids out for a day or a few hours. Send them a meal or fill their fridge out. Yes. Come and clean their house. I have beautiful friends that took me out when I was okay. They take me out for a coffee and just to feel normal, just to have those little moments of normality. And those are the things that I think really help, especially for the family as well. The caregivers, often forgotten because they're focused on the person with cancer. But I think of whether it's your daughter or your partner, that they need that support as well. Yeah. So I think it can be very hard, and I think it can be hard for women to say, this is the help that I need, because we often get so used to being the carers and the givers.
Yeah. And the other thing is, and you're absolutely right, I said that in the book, caregivers are, they're amazing. I don't think they get enough credit, because a lot of the people assume that the wife is going to do it or the kids are going to do it or whatever. Yeah. And a lot of times they're in over their heads, because they're not just, like, my daughter had her own family, she had her own husband, she was pregnant. And she was working, and she couldn't just drop everything because my husband and I were sick. I mean, still the practical things of her life had to be done as well. And I just gave them, both of my daughters, I just gave them so much credit because they realized it as well. And that's when they started calling their friends and other members of the family and saying, we need. And caregivers don't get enough credit and enough support, I don't think.
No, definitely not. Mm. No. And I was thinking, actually, as you've been talking, because I know, obviously, you're going through your experience, and I know with leukemia, you mentioned it before, that often the treatment really is that they strip back that immune system, and it's a pretty intensive process. What was it like when you'd both come out the other end of your treatment, you're both finished, you're both, I'm going to assume, we're probably in that state that many of us recognize post-treatment. How do you sort of get on with life as a couple and within your family when you're both recovering after cancer treatment?
Yeah. It was tricky. It was tricky because one of the things, we both had PTSD. We were both, at different times, we were both fighting depression. Mm. It wasn't just, we're back in love and everything is fine. It was not at all.
Yeah.
We had to work through finding a balance because we were so off balance. And we had to work through our communication and had to find things to laugh at because everything had been so serious and so dark and unstable. Mm. So it was a lot of work. It was a lot of work. There was no doubt that we loved each other. Mm. But again, we had both been so distant and so apart going through things separately. Our treatments were totally different. Our medication, people who haven't had cancer think that chemo is just one chemo and it's for all of cancer. And when there's about, oh, let me see, I think there's at least 85 different cancers and 85 different chemo. And people who just think there's one chemo or just one kind of radiation or whatever, when the whole world is totally different.
Yeah.
So we really had to work on it. One of the things we started doing was taking long walks and spending time talking, but also the walks helped us to heal because the doctors were saying, get out and walk and exercise.
Yeah.
And so the walks started helping us to talk and see where I was or where he was. We had to, my diet was totally liquid for 2 years.
Wow.
Because I couldn't swallow. I had to learn how to swallow. Something as simple that you take for granted as swallowing.
Yeah.
But because the radiation and the feeding tube, my swallowing muscles had atrophied. And so here my husband is able to eat and I'm still either on a feeding tube or taking something through a straw. That made going out to dinner interesting. Oh, that's going on a dinner date. That might work for you, but for me, not so much. So we found our way back. He was more than patient because he was a lot faster than I was.
Wow.
It took me a year. It took me 2 to 3 years. Whereas once he started coming back, he was taking care of me for a whole nother.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I think this is, as I've sort of touched on it, is that it really is, and it's not just that time you're in treatment. It is that process afterwards. And, you know, I had PTSD as well afterwards because it was such a, it's such a huge thing to happen. And I mean, I still struggle to go to the doctors now because there's just this thing now of just being scared of tests, even if it's just a routine blood test. And there's so much that doesn't get talked about. They don't say, and once you're finished, you're going to just be this sort of shell of a person.
One of the things that I must say is that my husband ended up having a second cancer.
Oh.
Here we were seven, eight years, no recurrence. And then 3 years ago, the same thing, the fatigue and the I'm tired and just and swellings. And I was like, oh my God, your leukemia is your leukemia back. But he had just been 6 months before. That's what I'm saying, the PTSD. 6 months before he had been tested, blood test, everything. You're still in remission. Then here we are one day and he's, I'm tired and I can't do this. And then we go and now he's got Hodgkin's lymphoma, another blood cancer. Not the ALL, not the acute lymphoblastic leukemia. Now he's got lymphoma. And the whole thing started all over again. And it was like, wow, we just went through this and we're just even and everything is going well again. And now we got lymphoma. And it's pretty much the same treatment, which presented a problem because he, you know, your body can only take so much. And he had used up, let's just say 70% of it dealing with the ALL, the leukemia.
Yes.
And now a lot of the same medicines are required for the lymphoma. So what are we going to do? And you only got 30%. And if the lymphoma needs 70% or 50%, what are we going to do? Mm-hmm. That was a major setback and a major worry. But over the 7 years since he had the leukemia, they had the immunotherapies and the stem cell transplants and those kinds of things. So we were looking at that. But fortunately, he didn't need. They had enough of the standard of care drugs, and it put him in remission.
Oh, gosh. Oh, my goodness. It just, And I think that this is something that, I mean, one of the reasons I started this podcast was I felt like there really wasn't a guideline of how do you get your life back together after cancer. They're just, and I think because I had to go back to work and those sorts of things, because I was 37 when I had breast cancer. And so I had to go back and, restart my career, but I couldn't really work and all of these things. And there just wasn't anywhere that said, all right, there's some things you can do. So one of the things that I really enjoy talking to people about is, you know, how have you done it? How do you get your life back? And how do you live with the fear of reoccurrence? Or how do you hold on to hope? And it sounds like similar to me that you've had it hasn't been a quick or easy healing process. So talk to me a little bit about how you have approached healing, whether that's emotionally or physically or spiritually.
One of the things that happened that I think, I don't know if they have this in New Zealand, and it's fairly new in the U.S., but after I started getting better, stronger, I decided to also get a little smarter about this. University, Winship, had started this program called Patient Family Advocacy.
Yeah.
And I decided that I could help heal myself by helping others and by being an advocate for people who, and caregivers and patients and families who were going through. So that I could take my experience and say, other than the medical part, other than the doctor part, as I call it, but some of the questions you're asking, how do you deal with neuropathy? What's your feelings about these things? Because the doctor doesn't have time to ask you those feeling kinds of questions. They're doing the practical medical stuff.
Yeah.
Are some of the things we're talking about. Recurrence. How do you stop worrying about that every day?
Yeah.
Or every time it's time for a test and start getting nervous and anxious and, you know, and we talk about anxiety. I decided to become a patient family advocate and they had training about things you can talk about. There's also a program called Peer Partner where you are partnered with someone who has the cancer that you had. So you can tell them your experience and give them hope. And so I found that helped me heal because then I could look at somebody and I could say, I'd walk through the infusion center. I could say, you know what? 4 or 5 years ago, I was sitting right where you're sitting. And so I want to represent hope to you that you can get through it. I think it was important for my husband as well that we could share our experience, and we do. We go places and we speak and we talk about our experience because it is so unusual.
Yeah.
I've met a few people. I've met people who've had both the partners have had cancer, but not at the same time.
No.
I met a father and daughter who had cancer, maybe 6 to 8 months apart again, but not at the exact same time. I've not met anybody that's had the experience my husband and I have.
No.
But like I said, I think I've helped myself heal by helping others and by being an advocate for cancer patients.
I think it's so important, isn't it? And to be able to, I think it's almost like it helps you make sense of what's happened. Or gives it, I mean, I don't think we get cancer for a reason as such. Obviously, our cells have gone nuts and decided that they will act in that way. But I feel like it's almost, I don't want to say easier, but part of a healing process to go, this is how I can make meaning out of this. So I think it is quite an important part of that process.
And that's why it was important for me to write the book, because I tell people this. I decided to write the book because everybody, whenever we would, at the hospital, we were like celebrities walk in the hospital and they go, oh, that's the Rosses. They both have cancer. My doctors were constantly asking me about my husband and his doctors were constantly asking him about me. But whenever we would talk, people would say, oh, you should write a book. You should tell your story. And it wasn't in writing the book, and you talked about how did we also come together. The writing the book was very healing because one of the first things I had to do was sit down and interview about his experience. I had no idea what he went through. And I sat down and I was like, okay, act like I'm not your wife and I'm going to interview you. And the things that I learned from him and his experience and how different his was than mine. But then I also learned about his fears, which is something while he was going through. And I learned about how lonely he was going through and how worried he was about me. And just and hearing his journey. Okay. And then, like you said, trying to make sense out of it. And then our journey together and our separate journeys. And then I interviewed my daughters. I really had to interview them to see what they were thinking and going through and hearing how afraid they were that they were going to lose one of us or both of us.
Yeah.
And how helpless they felt and how they were leaning on each other, calling each other and crying. And oh, if one took us to the hospital, then she would come back and she would talk to the other sister, to her sister. And it, like I said, writing the book, it was very healing as well, because I learned so much from them.
That would have been so insightful to go through that process. And it does come out in the book, really, of personal it feels. And I think that, and I'll put the links in the show notes, and you can either get a physical copy or, like me, download it onto my Kindle and enjoy it. But I think that it's a really fantastic book for anyone who's been impacted by cancer, whether you are the person, the loved one, the caregiver, to give that probably quite a reassuring insight that actually your experience is normal. It's normal to feel frightened or angry at the situation or unsure. But there is a part of your story that I think is very important, and I think it's important to talk about, is advocating within the health system for people of color and for that, just those disparity in healthcare.
Mm-hmm. It is COVID here in the United States. I know it's worldwide, but the medical field has long known that there is disparity of care. Known it. And anytime it came up, especially in the research hospitals, such as the university hospitals, such as Emory University, and they'd known it for years, but it was never a priority. And it was always something that they knew, but they didn't talk about it, or they didn't deal with it. It was always, okay, we know about this, but we're going to do this and this and this first. And then we'll come back around to this, okay? Once COVID hit and the numbers were staggering for people of color that were just dying, just not even making it to the hospital. Mm-hmm. Or making it to the hospital and then there's not getting the care, or showing up at the hospital with so many underlying conditions that they couldn't even treat the COVID.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah. And it was the same with cancer. It was what I've learned over the last 5 or 6 years in my advocacy and in my education of going to other hospitals and other situations. Is that it was the same way with cancer, that people of color were dying from cancers that other people were at least 5 years, making their survival rates 5 years or more, like I am now. Mm. And part of it was the insurance discussion.
Right.
You know, so we're not going to treat you because you don't have Cadillac insurance. Or part of it was the insurance discussion. Part of it was the overall fear that a lot of people of color have about going to the hospitals and being used as guinea pigs, which is historical. It's a historical fact that African Americans in particular, in a lot of cases, were used as guinea pigs for medicines and treatments or whatever, and never had any intentions of healing, of being healed. And so now all of this is out, and again, what are you going to do about it? It comes back to that. Now that you know, how are you going to address? And so what I'm seeing now is that there are different programs. There's a research program now called All of Us, here in the United States. It's called All of Us. I don't think it's global, where they are actually trying to do things and trying to do patient education. First of all, that is so important. I don't care if you have a hangnail. Okay. It's important that you're educated so that you know what you need so that the hangnail doesn't turn into something else and through an infection. So patient education is important. Mm. And so there are programs now that are talking about patient education. There are programs now to assure people of color and that you're not going to be used as a guinea pig, that, you know, that you will be treated like everybody else. There's this whole new thing, the programs on nutrition, you know, about what you need to eat to address your underlying conditions, exercise, fresh air, water, the whole nine. They are starting to address. And my advocacy is, what I do in my advocacy most of the time is I talk to the patients, but I also talk to doctors and nurses and the people at the hospital, and they listen. They want to hear the patient point of view. Yeah. They want to hear people of color coming in and say, this is what we need to make us feel comfortable. This is what we need to feel safe when we come and heard when we come to the hospital. So yes, that's a big part of what I do, a major part of what I do.
And I mean, I'm a white woman, so I can't talk to that experience. I know here in New Zealand, all of those things that you're talking about, issues for our Indigenous people, our Māori people, and also Pacifica people, because during exactly what you're talking about, especially with COVID and the populations or the groups that have been impacted the most, especially as Delta has come in, are our Indigenous people and Pacifica. Mm-hmm. And it's exactly those same things, is that distrust in a white medical system that has not served them at all. So why would they trust them now in an emergency? Yeah, so I think that message, especially for white people, is so important to hear, that this is what is going on and this is how it impacts other people. And now how are we going to dismantle the structures that have caused that?
Right.
So it's... Right.
And with the COVID, because it is contagious, if you don't address it with everybody, you might as well really not address it. If you don't fully address it, let me put it like this. If you don't fully address it, then if your Indigenous people get it, it's just a matter of time before it spreads to the other population. Because if you don't, you have to, it's not like cancer, where cancer is not contagious.
Yeah.
Okay, but when you're talking about a contagion, that's everybody.
Mm-hmm. It is. It is such an important message. And I think that it's important for New Zealanders white New Zealanders to hear it, because this is what we're experiencing now with COVID. Although in so many respects, our government have done an amazing job with the response. Okay. But now what we're seeing is where that disparity is. And who are the cases that are in hospital and who are the cases in ICU? And I think it can be very easy to be in your bubble thinking, this isn't impacting me, but it is impacting.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, it is.
And the problem is worldwide. It is global. It's global. It's not local. It's not just, you know, it's global.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It has been such a pleasure to talk to you and hear and get to hear more about your story from talking to you and reading your book. If people have listened to this and are inspired and would like to find your book, it's on Amazon, like I mentioned. It's Stronger With Two, the inspiring true story of a husband and wife winning the battle against cancer together. And that's Barry Roberts Ross. Where else can we find you? Do you have a website or a social media if you'd like to connect?
I do. I am on Facebook as Barry Roberts. I have a webpage called BarryEllenRoss.com. I'm on Instagram, Stronger With Two. And the book's also at Barnes & Noble, Walmart. It's in quite a few places. You can order it off online. Yeah. Or you can do the Kindle, as you said. You can get the paperback. or you can do Kindle.
I'll put all the links in the show notes as well so people can access those. So it is, I think it's so important when you've been through cancer to find those stories of inspiration and strength and hope. And but all of the stuff in between, it's really, I think it's important to hear those stories. So thank you for sharing with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I had to pinch myself that I'm actually in New Zealand.
Yes.
I do. I love that.
Thanks so much for listening. The C Word is every Sunday at 11:55 a.m. on Auckland's 104.6 Planet FM. And anytime at www.planetaudio.org.nz/the C Word.
things you want are real. You have you to complete, and there is a there's a midget standing tall, and a giant beside him about to
left up to you.